It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As one biologist put it, it's going to take a while to catch up to the basic vagina biology before we can put more of it together. We take a tour through the uncharted, a group of organs that get lumped together as the female reproductive system, largely described by men through the ages of medicine, assumed to have that sole purpose, to make babies. Join in on this anatomy tour, gender identity surgery, menstruation, endometriosis, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Science journalist Rachel E. Gross's new book is called Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. Rachel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. That was an amazing intro.
Oh, thank you for that. Well, let's start with Roe before anatomy, because your book came out before the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision overturning abortion protections. So if you could add a chapter to your book on abortion, what would it be about? What would it say?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So that's right. The book came out before we had really an inkling that this was going to happen. It was finished up last December. And I remember this news happening and, like many Americans, feeling very helpless and lost. And in my case, wondering what I could add, like what I had to say on this. And I realized that a lot of my book actually doesn't focus on pregnancy, reproduction, and conception. It's really trying to zoom out and show that women and people who identify as women and intersex people are full people who do more than have babies or not have babies. And I really feel like abortion bans like this kind of perpetuate that old notion of women as walking wombs or baby incubators. And it really distorts the focus, because care for these organs we're talking about, the vagina, vulva, clitoris, and uterus and ovaries, goes far beyond baby-making properties, which I can get into.
Mm. But why have the abortion medications, or what you call the tools of abortion, why have they become completely engulfed by this sole purpose of pregnancy termination?
Right. So this book goes a lot into the history of the science and the technology that we have. And what you often find is that discoveries and advancements are made for a reason, and they get politicized even in their making, in the questions we ask and in how we develop certain tools. It's all really like baked in with cultural assumptions. And yeah, I think it's clear that these tools have been intentionally kind of wrapped up in being about abortion, and that they've been specifically attacked. So like misoprostol and MIFI, like it's a very common misconception that you can just take out these tools from gynecological care without huge repercussions, because they're used, as people are beginning to realize now, for miscarriage, for chronic illnesses, for things like PCOS and endo in some cases, endometriosis, I mean. So really, this stuff is all connected. And that's a huge theme of the book, is that this is a unified system, and you can't remove certain tools and certain techniques without disrupting the whole body.
I'm going to reintroduce you here a moment. Rachel E. Gross, science journalist, previous editor at the Smithsonian Magazine, as we talk about reproduction, sex organs, how certain bodies have been largely overlooked by science, as we tour through her new book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Rachel, for centuries, researchers understood female anatomy only as it relates to male anatomy. And you give that example where ovaries were called female testis until the 1600s. How has that mindset prevailed and held back research about female sexuality and about these organs?
Yes. So The ovaries, yeah, did not have their own name until the 1600s. Until then, they were assumed to be some version of testicles, and we didn't really know what they did. Maybe they produced female sperm, not quite sure. And that's totally indicative of a view that was really prevalent, starting in Greek times, that women were often seen as inferior and sometimes like inside out or unfinished men. So the vagina was sometimes seen as an inside-out penis, and the ovaries as internal testes. And this view served to kind of prevent scientists from looking at the female body in its own right and from asking questions like, how do the ovaries actively develop in the womb? Until extremely recently, it was often said they develop by default, as if the female body is like your iPhone on factory settings and the male body is like all the bells and whistles. And that means that we're not studying these basic processes. And another example is that the clitoris for centuries has been sort of like lost and found through history and has disappeared from textbooks and has been described as like a diminutive phallus or an unformed penis. In not so many words. And again, that means that researchers never fully mapped this really extensive organ and really like taught it to medical students, people who are going to treat these bodies. So it's only very recently that female pleasure and sexuality has been kind of prioritized, not by all, but by some, as an end in itself and as being crucial to someone's health and well-being. So we've had these huge gaps in the map of anatomy, and it's not niche. It's not just like, quote, women's health, because these are half the bodies on Earth. So a gap, a knowledge gap in this realm means a knowledge gap about all bodies.
It was fascinating too that in the 1850s there was the surgical amputation of clitoris, and that, I mean, people were removing them to cure nervous disorders. And then you fast forward, take us to the early 2000s, and we're learning that this organ, there it is interconnected with this whole network of tissues. What has been discovered about it?
Yeah, so the clitoris, even to this day, though I think it's getting a little better, is sometimes thought of as this little nub, as the part you can see and touch. And the clitoris is really the organ of pleasure. It is completely homologous to the penis, even though it is its own special thing and has a very unique shape. If you look up shape of the clitoris, you will see that it's kind of this penguin spaceship, like object, and it actually has a ton of erectile tissue. It has these bulbs that hug the vagina and actually engorge with arousal, and these arms that flare back into the pelvis. And the part that was referred to as the whole clitoris, the nub, is really just the head or equivalent to the glands of the penis. And it has a shaft that connects to those other parts. And it really interacts with every part of the pelvis. It hugs the urethra, the vagina. So this is kind of the appreciation that we're learning, thanks to a lot of explorers. One of them that I profile in the book is Dr. Helen O'Connell, the first female urologist in Australia. And she is kind of credited with discovering the clitoris by using modern tools and microdissection to kind of get a better idea of that shape. So what we know now is that the clitoris is more than 90% beneath the surface. It's 10 times bigger than most people thought when Helen O'Connell was doing her research. And it's really involved in every part of arousal and sexuality. And there's not really a difference between what some might call the vaginal orgasm and the clitoral orgasm. It all kind of originates in this organ. So it's a lot more important and extensive than we maybe thought.
Science journalist Rachel E. Gross, our guide to exploring female anatomy from a medical, from a social, historical perspective. Her book, Vagina Obscura, gives us insights into not just female bodies, but all bodies. We'll talk more about that. Join in on these organs, what you've always wanted to know about what Rachel calls the delicate biochemical dance that is fertilization. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're on a voyage of discovery, confronting how little is known about female biology and a group of organs. I found Rachel E. Gross's writing about the vaginal microbiome breathtaking. From afar, it looks like a dictatorship, but it's more of a negotiation with thousands of minute interactions and partnerships happening under the surface. Join in on the ovary's enduring mysteries, what you wonder, considering the full scope of these organs and tissues. 800-642-1234. Rachel's book is Vagina Obscura, and she stays with us. Rachel, the vaginal microbiome, it was so exotic and foreign and really magical in your words. Can you explain this complex?
I'm so glad you found it that way. Yes, your vagina is another planet. It has its own ecosystem. And if you zoomed in between your own legs, you would find millions and millions of microbes. So think of the gut microbiome that we're getting more familiar with. These are basically all these communities that work together to keep you in balance. And in the case of the vagina, they're often serving a defense function. They're protecting you from invaders, which might be tampons, toys, penises, the anus. And they're really, really important. So I basically think of the vaginal microbiome as an extension of your immune system, because again, it's protecting you from things that are not you and kind of keeping this homeostasis. But the important players, there are a lot of different players, but some that scientists have identified are called lactobacilli, and they're the same genus of bacteria found in milk and yogurt. And what they do is ferment sugars and create lactic acid, and they keep the vagina at around the pH of a glass of red wine, which I love. So yeah, basically there's a whole world going on down there and it's keeping you safe. And I felt a lot more grateful for it after I got really into it, writing this book. And researchers now are trying to work to optimize this protective balance and to kind of strengthen it for people that get problems like recurrent infections, STIs, and other things that might interfere with its health.
Right, because there's bacterial vaginosis, BV, and that is very prevalent. How do doctors look at that now and treat it and influence what they prescribe for medication?
Right. So BV, which I'd never heard of until a few years ago, is like an ecosystem shift in the vagina. If we go with this metaphor, where instead of lactobacilli, you end up with kind of a diversity of other organisms, and it can lead to itching. It can lead to worse birth outcomes, and it can have a smell. And so it's pretty annoying, and it comes back again and again for a lot of people. So as I found out the hard way, maybe 5 years ago now, there aren't many good cures for this super common condition that affects 1 in 3 women. And the last resort is something called boric acid that is essentially rat poison, as my gynecologist told me. And you put in this suppository and it's supposed to sort of level the ecosystem and remove all life. And it doesn't work that well. Like, it generally comes back. So now they're working on new things like vaginal probiotics. So again, you could insert a much healthier mix of microbes into your vagina. These are ones that actually are inserted, not oral. And they're working on vaginal microbiome transplants between different women that they ultimately might be able to like synthesize, which is exactly what we did for the gut microbiome. We basically made synthesized fecal transplants.
One dangerous practice to the microbiome is douching or washing the inside of the vagina. Why can douching be harmful to the microbiome?
Yeah. So if you're thinking of this protective layer that's kind of in this balance, I sort of think of it as a garden where it's okay, like different species come in, it's fine to have some weeds, but generally there's a balance. And if you're putting anything in the vagina that strips away all of those protective organisms, then you're really messing with that balance. And whatever grows back to kind of fill that niche is not necessarily going to be the most helpful mixture for you. So douching and a lot of these other practices that are supposed to be about cleansing the vagina actually really harm the vagina's natural protection. And FYI, the vagina does not need cleansing.
Rachel E. Gross with us, science journalist. Her new book is called Vagina Obscura, an Anatomical Voyage. You can join in as we talk about the medical research, the animal vaginas. We'll get to that. Female sex organs, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Leslie in Milwaukee. Leslie, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I just have a question about birth control. I know personally myself, I've been on birth control since I was in high school and didn't realize how harmful it would be to my body at the time. I didn't know what questions to ask. And over 10 years later, I was still on the same pill, a hormonal pill, and started to do some own research into the effects that it has on my body, maybe some of the things that it's affecting my mood, my entire reproductive system. So I'm just wondering what research there is on the effects of that, how it's being taught to folks when they are asking for birth control prescriptions or more information, and what we can do to understand more about our bodies and the things that we're putting in our bodies and how they affect us.
Leslie, thank you so much. Rachel.
Yeah, thank you so much, Leslie. I do want to say I'm not a doctor, so I can't tell you exactly the effects of long-term birth control, though I've heard lots of stories like that. What you are making me think of is I have a chapter that gets into hormones and sort of the history of how we've thought of estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, the first of two, which are in many of the pills. And really, they've often been described as like female sex hormones, with the idea that they only impact the uterus and the reproductive organs, which like they do in a strong way. They actually mean that your uterine lining during menstruation doesn't get as thick and is like less welcoming to a potential egg, which is what you want out of birth control. But hormones are really like this very body-wide phenomenon that affects like every process and tissue in the body. And I've been told they really should be called growth hormones. So I was kind of blown away to learn that estrogen and testosterone both are completely required in all types of bodies, actually. So testosterone is really important for ovulation. Estrogen is really important for bone growth, brain health. So it stands to reason that if you're inserting like regular doses of these kind of hormones for a really long time, they are going to have body-wide effects, and it makes sense that it could affect your mood. I was going to say like an antidepressant, but this is more body-wide. And I think some doctors often will prescribe a more localized thing like an IUD as an alternative. Like, just from experience, it feels like we often have to make ourselves into like a one-person experiment for things like birth control and antidepressants, and that the messaging you get is that you just have to keep trying them till you find what works for you. And that's, you know, like, these are really big effects that can be long lasting, and maybe you can't afford and don't want to be depressed for months to figure this out. So that's not ideal. I think there are some other books that get into kind of like wider surveys about people who have been on the pill for a long time. But I think we're honestly just starting to get that kind of data. The pill is kind of a huge experiment that's only been going on since the 60s in this country. So I think you're right that the effects are far more and far less understood than we know.
It's amazing that they are, because so many people are on the pill. You would think that there would be more research.
I think, yes. And I think really at the time that the pill was created and disseminated, the question was, will it work? Uh-huh. Will it prevent pregnancy? And it worked so well that we haven't had and doing longitudinal studies over the whole lifetime is difficult. So there definitely is some data, but I didn't come across anything really robust about what the difference is between taking different types of birth control for 10 years of your life and what it's like to get off them. I mostly came across anecdotal evidence.
Author Rachel E. Gross, our guide on anatomy, the vaginal microbiome, the hidden scientists we'll talk about who pushed the Academy to ask questions about organs that were believed to be inferior to male anatomy. Join in on sex and gender, tissue regeneration, fertilization, endometriosis. We're going to talk about that. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the vast knowledge gap and fresh insights into organs that get lumped under the heading, oh, that's just for making babies, the uterus, ovaries, vagina. Author Rachel E. Gross's new book takes us deeply into this anatomy with detailed examples of how it has long been under-researched, mislabeled, and stigmatized. Join in on Vagina and Colleagues, as Rachel calls it. What you want to know about these organs, their contributions to the body as a whole? 800-642-1234. The book is Vagina Obscura, and Rachel E. Gross stays with us. Rachel, we were talking about the pill there, and I want to look more deeply at endometriosis affecting 200 million people around the world, little known about the disease. What did you find there?
Yeah, endometriosis is like basically it's when cells similar to those of the lining of the uterus start growing outside the uterus. And these are really dynamic cells that are normally the ones that are involved in menstruation. So every month, your uterine lining will build up, it'll grow new blood vessels. And thanks to a kind of hormonal signal that's very intricate, it'll know exactly when to die and shed and then grow itself again, like scarlessly without wounds. It's an incredible regenerative process. But when it happens outside of where it's supposed to happen, it's incredibly painful, causes a lot of problems, can kind of stick organs together and can affect your fertility. So I think that awareness has really grown over the past 5 years as I've seen it, that this is a painful and for some debilitating disease. But the history of it is really it being lumped in with things like hysteria and being considered a psychosomatic disease. And so many people I talked to were told by their doctor to basically go see a psychologist, take antidepressants, or like stop being so uptight and have a glass of wine. So there's really a history of it being dismissed and not being taken seriously. And that's what I think is a universal theme for a lot of chronic illnesses that mostly affect women and people with this anatomy.
Physicians commonly recommend pregnancy as a way to relieve symptoms. What are other solutions to reducing the symptoms, and why do they still point to pregnancy?
Fortunately, pregnancy not as commonly, but I definitely spoke to plenty of people who were told, you know, like a decade ago, oh, you should just get pregnant, or if you were thinking of getting pregnant, now's the time to do it. Research has definitely debunked that that would solve this problem at all. It was thought you could kind of shut down the hormonal system and that would help, but that's not how it works. Pregnancy is a very complex event and it's a super misogynist and outdated way to address any disease. So there are not that many options, but there are some that work well for a lot of people. And actually, the birth control pill is very commonly prescribed as sort of leveling the hormone levels to help with this disease, which is kind of hormonally pushed. And cutting out the disease is a really big one, either with lasers or surgical tools. But a lot of people do have to have multiple surgeries and it can grow back. Because again, it's very dynamic and it grows in a lot of places. So it's really in need of new solutions. And I go into some researchers in my book who are looking at just that. So some of them are using menstrual blood as a biopsy or a diagnostic tool to see the condition of the uterus and to look for clues about inflammation, disease, fertility. And others are thinking about chronic inflammation and how you might tamp that down early on before someone has even developed the disease to kind of nip it in the bud. Mm-hmm. But there's no silver bullet yet.
Dr. Griffith's lab at MIT, you take us there, and that was just so amazing, too. Her work with tissue regeneration and her own personal story with endometriosis.
That's right. Yeah, Dr. Linda Griffith is a bioengineer, and so she was really integral in the early days of kind of building organs from scratch in the lab. She built something called the ear mouse that any biology student has seen, a mouse with an ear on its back. But it would be 20 years of kind of dealing with this disease silently, which was incredibly brutal for her and her career, before she decided that she needed to turn her scientific lens to the uterus. And she really had to realize that she was the only one who was going to do this. She was in a very male-dominated field that was interested in organs that regenerate, but had somehow overlooked the uterus, which is maybe the most regenerative organ. And, you know, it's, you work in a certain culture, and science has a very masculine culture a lot of times, and there are things that are okay and not okay to say and to look into. And she really kind of established her career first and spoke the language of her field before she made a lab dedicated to figuring out endometriosis, how it starts and how to stop it. And I think now she's actually working on kind of menstruation science as a whole, because as it turns out, even menstruation is not fully understood.
Rachel E. Gross with us, science journalist, new book, Vagina Obscura. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Carla is with us from Fox Lake. Carla, what would you like to bring up?
Hi, good morning. My daughter has PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and has been told by several doctors that it's going to be difficult for her to become pregnant. I'm wondering if you can tell me, either anatomically, chemically, on a molecular level, what is it about this syndrome that makes pregnancy difficult?
Carla, thank you. Do you have any insights there, Rachel?
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. I'm not an expert on PCOS, unfortunately. What I can say is I've talked to women who have been diagnosed with this early on and have been told the same thing and ended up not having problems with their fertility. I can't speak to large trends, but I've definitely heard doctors kind of address this like difficulty getting pregnant really early on, and really maybe focus more on that than they need to, or then ends up being relevant later. So I hesitate to give advice, especially medical advice, but it sounds like maybe someone who really specializes in this would have more information, rather than like, this typically leads to fertility problems and could do, more of a personal workup.
Well, conventional sex ed says women have a fixed number of eggs in their ovaries at birth, and those eggs gradually degenerate. But there is more to the story than that. Can you explain the research of John Tilley and Dr. Dori Woods?
Yeah, this was like a wild and mind-blowing moment for me in this book. I'd been taught, and in biology class, exactly what you said, that women are born with all the eggs they'll ever have, and all they do is run out until you hit menopause. And, you know, there is reality to that. Menopause is a real thing. But there is now a lot of data, 10 years of evidence, that there are actually stem cells in human ovaries that can give rise to new eggs. And We don't have all the research about what they're doing in the human body because most of the research is on mice, other animals, or human cells, but in the lab. So they're like in a petri dish. But it seems like they could be creating new eggs throughout the lifetime, which changes a lot of what we know about menopause and kind of how we think of what the female body is capable of.
It's interesting how you found Tilly's research was dismissed by the medical community and you know, scientists accusing Tilly of falsifying results, you know, difficulty finding a job. What did you see there that, you know, in the push that Tilly had to continue the research?
Yeah, it was a really huge controversy, probably the biggest within ovarian biology that I'd ever seen. And tensions were running really high. It was very emotional. And whenever I see that happening in science, I always like take a step back and kind of ask, what's really the cause of this? So in this case, he was basically suggesting overturning 60, 70 years of biologists thinking they understood how the ovary works. So this is a huge like threat to the paradigm, similar to saying that the earth revolves around the sun. So if you spent your whole career thinking one way, this is a lot to take in. There are also elements of Dr. Tilly is a real like forceful guy. He is very charismatic and convincing. And some scientists said he felt more like a salesman, which is just not kind of with the culture of being very hesitant, cautious, and just like not wanting to speculate. And meanwhile, Dr. Tilly was like, hey, at some point we're going to be able to make babies with this. We might be able to stop menopause. So there was kind of the delivery. So it's kind of these non-scientific elements. But one theme that I really tapped into and talked to scientists about was there was kind of this attachment to the idea that the male body was profoundly different than the female body. And that one of the things that made it so was that the testes produce sperm all the time, and men produce like 1500 sperm every time they breathe. And the ovaries, by contrast, like they're not as dynamic. They degenerate. They literally are said to fail or exhaust themselves during menopause, which, by the way, is not true. They're actually still producing hormones and might still have eggs. But that there were these kind of entrenched assumptions about differences between the sexes that were stopping people from accepting that actually maybe regeneration is happening along with degeneration. These processes can both be happening at once.
There is also this pushback about, you know, why, if we can figure out how to pause menopause or how to put it off or stop it. And the researchers like, why would we want to do that? And you found some real reasons as to why that would be the case.
Why we wouldn't want to do that?
Why we would want to, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you're right. That was actually also a huge flashpoint. This suggestion that we might be able to delay menopause indefinitely really raises people's hackles, and for some good reason. There's kind of this idea that menopause is like a disease or bad when it's totally a natural phase in life, and many people would never want to not have it. But that's not what these researchers were suggesting. First of all, if they were to, so this would be kind of using stem cells from the ovary to create kind of an unlimited source of new eggs. And those eggs come with hormone producing cells. And so if you make enough of those, you can kind of have like an artificial ovary that continues producing these hormones that support the whole body after menopause. That's the idea. And really the use for that first would be people who go through cancer treatments and who lose the function of their ovaries early, and people that have conditions that lead to ovaries running out of eggs early. So it wouldn't be first for the general population. But yes, there's this increasing interest in, well, if I know menopause was really bad in my family and I know that people in my family had brittle bones and heart issues, then maybe I want to put that off 10 years. And there are already doctors doing a version of this by taking out strips of your ovaries, freezing it, and promising to put it back in later on in life. And like, no idea how that's going to work because they haven't put them in yet. But basically, these interventions are happening in the free market. And so having the baseline research on it pretty compelling. And I personally think it's just interesting that it causes so many tensions and emotions. Again, I kind of zoom in on moments like that and kind of ask, what are people actually really upset about here?
Rachel E. Gross, science journalist, new book, Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. Still time to talk about reproduction, anatomy questions, gender affirmation surgery, and the fascinating language origins connected to the female anatomy. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We talk about the new book, Vagina Obscura, and this journey to explore all bodies through the lens of what people have historically thought of as the female body. Still time to talk about the science of women's bodies, what scientists are working to solve through the scope of these once mysterious body parts seen only for their reproductive qualities. 800-642-1234. Author Rachel E. Gross stays with us. Rachel, it's really cool how you take us by the hand in a way to view all bodies through the language of the female body. Can you talk about your approach to terminology and the diversity and inclusion aspect?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And I really commend you for the challenge that can be in radio when you don't have as many words. And, you know, we have to kind of balance clarity with this nuance. That was definitely a big challenge in this book. So I did go about thinking I was going to look into the female reproductive system. And I was thinking the ovaries, the uterus, the vagina, the clitoris, the vulva. And I was thinking like lady parts. It very quickly became clear to me that that phrase was super inadequate to describe what I was thinking about. So like there are so many combinations of these parts. And I talked to people, you know, who had a hysterectomy, who didn't have a uterus, people who were intersex, who had different combinations of these body parts. I talked to trans men, trans women, and non-binary people. And these body parts like touch on people's lives in so many different ways. So a female was just out. Really, it's so much broader than that. And then reproductive, as you've been alluding to, really casts these organs all in one very narrow lens as being baby-making organs that sit around not doing much the rest of the time. But as we've been talking about, the ovaries, for instance, are producing hormones that support every single body system like throughout your lifespan. And of course, the vulva, the clitoris, the vagina are very involved in sexuality and pleasure, which have been super understudied. The vaginal microbiome is an extension of your immune system. There's a lot of immune biology happening there. And finally, the uterus is an incredibly regenerative organ that probably holds secrets for regenerative medicine and speaks to these processes happening throughout bodies. So, you know, that was definitely tricky because as a science journalist, I really do believe that you don't want to lose readers and you want to be clear and simple where you can. But I basically tried to cast as wide a net as possible when I could, and to remind people that I do use women's bodies as shorthand, and particularly when talking about history, because I'm talking about people who were traditionally considered women, and that's how science viewed them by virtue of having a uterus, et cetera. But I do try to point out other people that deal with this wherever it's relevant. So in the endometriosis chapter, I talked to a trans man, I talked to women of color, and to me, it's really important to see how their experience is similar and different from white middle-class women, because the farther you are, I found, from this kind of assumption about what women that have this disease should be like, the more you fall through the cracks, the more you face intersecting racism with the sexism, the more you can't access what is called women's healthcare, which is another kind of big thread that's being talked about in the abortion conversation right now, that who are we leaving out and who is most vulnerable? And when is it just inaccurate to say this is a women's problem? One way that comes into play as I mentioned, is that thinking of this as women's biology and women's health is a really narrow way of looking at the scientific and medical problem we're facing. If we literally know less about half the bodies on Earth, then we are missing enormous swaths of knowledge about all bodies. And discovering more about those bodies that we've been calling women's bodies is actually helping us like understand human health. And a couple concrete examples are the vaginal microbiome science happening now is making researchers realize how important the penile microbiome is and how it might be involved in disease transfer and protection. And the people looking into the roots of endometriosis find that there are these inflammatory patterns underlying it. And there may be similar ones in what we call male bodies that also could lead to fertility problems, even though there's no uterus involved. Mm. So it's really about, yeah, filling in the gaps and kind of widening the lens for everyone.
I want to land here on Dr. Marcy Bowers, this world-renowned gynecologist and surgeon specializing in gender confirmation surgeries. How is Dr. Bowers' approach to gender reaffirming surgery different from surgery done in previous decades?
Yeah, Dr. Bowers is a really, she's such an interesting person. She's the first trans woman in her field that we know of. And that and her long career in OBGYN really made her come to her work with a very different perspective than a lot of the male surgeons who came before her. So literally, as she describes it, in the 60s, when people were doing what was then called like male to female surgery, they were trying to make a hole for penetration. And the clitoris was totally an afterthought or not even considered often. And again, we've come 180 with people like Dr. Bowers who really focus on the clitoris and pleasure as central to this procedure and focus on the goals and the embodied experience of the person undergoing this and asks them what they're looking for, what's most important for them, like what do they want to get out of this. So we've really changed the goals from like, we want you to be what we think a woman should be in society and ideally disappear and marry someone and be in a heterosexual relationship to like, listen, we have the ability to create a beautiful and pleasurable organ, and we've been studying the vagina to do this. And like, the goal here is what you want the goal to be, which I find to be a really beautiful reframe.
Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel E. Gross, science journalist. New book is Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.